So hello everyone. Welcome to the Partners for Progressive Israel Conversations with Israel and Palestine program. Today we are speaking with Nathan Brown about internal governance issues in Gaza since the 2005 disengagement. So first, a few technical matters. All callers will be muted while Nathan is speaking. When we open the call to questions, you will be able to address Nathan by unmuting yourself. To unmute your call, you'll need to press star 6. I'll cover that again when it's time for Q&A, but again, you will press star 6 in order for us to hear you. Please remember to press star 6 again once you finish asking your question in order to remute your call, and this will help us cut down on background noise. So Nathan Brown received his BA in political science from the University of Chicago and his MA and PhD in politics and Near Eastern Studies from Princeton University. He teaches courses on Middle Eastern politics as well as more general courses on comparative politics and international relations. His dissertation received the Malcolm Kerr Award from the Middle East Studies Association. For 2013-2015, Dr. Brown is president of the Middle East Studies Association, the academic association for scholars studying the region. In 2013, he was named a Guggenheim Fellow. 4 years earlier, he was named a Carnegie Scholar by the Carnegie Corporation. In addition to his academic work, Brown serves on the Middle East and North Africa Advisory Committee for Human Rights Watch and the Board of Trustees at the American University in Cairo. He has also previously served as an advisor for the committee drafting the Palestinian Constitution, USAID, the United Nations Development Program, and several NGOs. So Nathan, please take it away.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. You can hear me?
Yeah. Loud and clear.
Okay, great. Okay. So what I thought I'd do is focus primarily on internal issues in Palestinian politics, especially in Gaza, but trying to put it a little bit in historical perspective and then also in perspective of recent rumors of diplomatic activity involving Gaza and Hamas on the one hand and Israel on the other. So my guess is we've got a fairly educated audience on the line. Let me say just a few things in general about Gaza, in case there's anybody who's less familiar. For those who are more familiar, this will tell you things you already know. I mean, the Gaza Strip is a narrow strip of land. It is along the Mediterranean. It has a population something like 1.5 million people, largely consisting of descendants of refugees from 1948. There was, of course, a population in Gaza City and some smaller towns in the Gaza Strip before that, but about 90% of the population are refugees or descendants of refugees. It is the economy of Gaza, being a small area and a very poor area, has always been dependent on movement and access of goods and labor to Egypt and to Israel, and to West Bank as well. That has basically come to a halt for reasons I'll talk about in a second, all but come to a halt, meaning essentially that right now the economy of the Gaza Strip is decimated. It is certainly, the population is kept afloat by very generous international assistance programs, but essentially you're dealing with a society that is still reeling from the effects of last summer's war, and in which reconstruction for a variety of reasons has been, mostly political in nature, has been very difficult. So that's the area that we're dealing with. Now let me try and say a little bit about sort of political structures in Gaza, and again going back in historical perspective, but fairly quickly. The area known as Gaza, or the Gaza Strip, is of course a creation of the outcome of the 1948 war, what the Israelis call the War of Independence, but Palestinians obviously do not know it by that name. But the reason that I mention that is that there was an attempt, as the British Mandate was coming to an end and as the state of Israel was being created, to create a Palestinian government, an independent Palestinian state in Gaza, headquartered in Gaza. They actually declared independence. They set up a cabinet in 1948, and they were essentially shut down in large part by the Arab League, and especially by Egypt, which did not want an independent Palestinian leadership while they were fighting a war. For that reason, from 1949 until 1967, although there was this technically an all-Palestine government that existed, that was in Cairo, the essentially the leaders, the Palestinian leadership was invited to Cairo and placed under house arrest there effectively, and Egypt administered the Gaza Strip directly. It did not annex Gaza, and in fact, later on in periods of Egyptian rule, it did allow some kind of internal governance among the Palestinian population there. So an awful lot of the administrative structures that exist in Gaza date back either to the British Mandate period or to the period of Egyptian rule, when there was a bureaucracy that was set up to run things like transportation, education, sanitation, and so on. But it was fairly rudimentary, that was not really run by Palestinians themselves, and there was some Palestinian participation. In 1967, of course, and then lasting until 1993, Israel controlled the Gaza Strip and set up a military administration, and then later on what it was called the civilian administration, although it still answered to the Ministry of Defense, that essentially took the role of the Egyptians, oversaw administration in Gaza, oversaw the bureaucracy. Most of the day-to-day administration was, of course, still handled by a Gazan population. Towards the end of that period, actually even before the signing of the Oslo Accords, the Israeli leadership was clearly thinking of somehow detaching Gaza from Israel. They had essentially opened the border, Act 1967, completely. In 1991-1992, they actually began constructing a fence around Gaza, anticipating that there will be some kind of separation. When the Oslo Accords were signed, the Palestinian Authority that was then being created under the Oslo Accords pledged to essentially observe and maintain that separation. So the Palestinian Authority is created in 1993-1994 to essentially take over what the Israeli civil administration had done, and it was, however, not supposed to be simply for Gaza alone, but it was supposed to unify Palestinian population living in both Gaza and the West Bank. And from a Palestinian perspective, essentially that Palestinian Authority was supposed to be the nucleus of a Palestinian state. They were supposed to build ministries, pass laws, build a legislature, write school curricula, and so on, in anticipation of a two-state solution which Palestinians would hope would come out of the Oslo process. That process obviously did not lead, it still has not led to a two-state solution, meaning that the Palestinian Authority was essentially left a little bit of a rump structure and began to lose an awful lot of legitimacy in Palestinian eyes because it didn't seem to be leading to the kind of Palestinian state that was hoped for, and the Palestinian Authority itself was characterized by patterns of authoritarianism and corruption. Detracting from its legitimacy. It still effectively ruled those areas in Gaza which were Palestinian populated. The Israeli settlements in Gaza continued until the unilateral disengagement by Israel from Gaza in 2005. In 2005 and 2006, there was a series of Palestinian elections. First, local elections, municipal elections, in which Hamas began to do well, and then parliamentary elections in January 2006, in which Hamas won an absolute majority of seats in the Legislative Council, and after some attempts to form a government of national unity, which failed, found itself forced, essentially, to form a cabinet, still under the leadership of a president, Abu Mazen Mahmoud Abbas from the Fatah Party. So from 2006 to 2007, you had this uneasy relationship between a presidency that was still committed to the peace process that was run by Fatah and a Hamas cabinet that was supposed to be administering Gaza in the West Bank, but was not committed to the two-state solution, not committed to the peace process, and under a variety of fairly severe international sanctions. That international pressure finally led, I think, or contributed to a Palestinian civil war in 2006, a very brief one, and lasted several days of fighting, in which the Hamas cabinet essentially took over control of Gaza, and the West Bank fell under the presidency and Fatah Party. Since that time, since 2006, summer of 2007, Gaza has been under Hamas rule, and there have been no elections, no local elections, no national elections since that point. Gaza essentially, and the Palestinian Authority bureaucracy, the education ministry, the health and so on, continued under Hamas control, the ministries in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, both belonging to the Palestinian Authority, are supposedly part of the same body, but effectively answer to two different executives, one in Gaza run by Hamas and one in the West Bank run by Fatah. Essentially, they do not communicate except on a few matters like secondary school exams and high school diplomas and that sort of thing. So Hamas has been essentially running the Gaza Strip since 2007. Hamas came under real pressure from within its own ranks and from the Gaza population, with complaints that essentially from its own ranks that this was a movement that was designed not to be an administrative body for a rump Palestinian state, but it was supposed to be the leaders of the Palestinian resistance to Israel and to Zionism and so on. And what they were effectively doing was turning into a big municipality. So there was some pressure within Hamas and some feeling that they'd been trapped in this arrangement, but they had no real way out. The population of Gaza, Hamas's performance was perhaps a little bit cleaner than Fatah's, and there are some allegations of corruption, but they are a little bit less severe than those against Fatah. But essentially, complaints that the Hamas was similarly claiming to be leading Palestinian population in resistance, but in effect had their actions had resulted in a closure of the Gaza Strip. For a variety of reasons, I think the Hamas leadership was unable to come up with any kind of alternative strategy, however. There were periodic waves of violence, essentially all-out warfare against Israel, most recently last summer. None of those really seemed to break the blockade on Gaza or give Hamas any alternative to this sort of short-term, or what they had hoped would be a short-term arrangement, but where they would be stuck and bottled up in Gaza. And as a result, the situation that existed in 2007 is not all that different from the situation that exists in 2015. After 8 years, Hamas can say essentially that they held on, that they haven't buckled under the pressure, but the population of the Gaza Strip is certainly suffering fairly severely from what has happened. And the governance of the Gaza Strip remains both authoritarian and in a sense ineffective. Politically in Gaza, you have, say, a fairly authoritarian government. Most other political factions are not allowed to operate. There's sharp controls of freedom of expression, freedom of the press, and so on. The only effective alternative social presence to Hamas in Gaza are a collection of Salafi movements, which Hamas is keeping a very close eye on, a few small factions like Islamic Jihad, which again Hamas is keeping a close eye on, and then a huge apparatus, actually, which Hamas is jealous of but fairly dependent on, and that's the United Nations Relief Works Agency, UNRWA, which provides education for a large portion of the Gazan population, as well as a host of other services. Hamas absolutely needs UNRWA because it cannot provide by itself for the Gazan population. But on the other hand, UNRWA is answerable to the United Nations. It's heavily dependent on outside donations and is therefore a social and even in some ways a political presence in Gaza that Hamas cannot completely control. Knowing that they were kind of stuck in this and trying virtually every single way they could think of to break out of this, and failing, Hamas finally last year did agree to a kind of reconciliation with Fatah and with Abu Mazen in the West Bank that involved the appointment of a government, a cabinet of technocrats. So the Hamas ministers all resigned, and a technocratic government was appointed by Abu Mazen. That technocratic cabinet did not include Hamas ministers, and it did include Fatah ministers, making Hamas feel that it had been cheated in the deal. And the ministries in Gaza are now effectively do not answer to the West Bank. The West Bank ministries do not wish to take responsibility for Gaza because they'll see themselves as essentially doing Hamas's dirty work for them. And as a result, you have right now a situation in which you don't even have a formal Hamas cabinet in Gaza, but essentially a collection of administrative bodies which effectively answer to Hamas, but in which there's no even formal mechanisms of accountability or clear ministries or clear lines or genes of command. That's a situation that is obviously bad for the people of the Gaza Strip, but it's bad for Hamas as well, leading to what I referred to at the beginning of the call as a series of attempts to negotiate with some kind of alternative arrangement. And you know, I'm sure many of you have seen the flurry of press reports of some kind of negotiations between the Israelis and Hamas about some kind of relaxation on the Israeli closure of Gaza in return for a long-term agreement with Israel. Significantly, most of those reports come from Hamas and from Gaza itself, or occasionally from Turkey or other sources. The accounts in the Israeli press often actually refer back to the Palestinian rumors. That leads me to suspect that what we're seeing is essentially an attempt by Hamas to find some kind of alternative to current arrangements. There are reasons why a short-term agreement with Hamas is not necessarily seen in ideological left-right terms in Israel. That is to say, there are people on the right who would, I think, entertain such an idea if it led to some kind of viable arrangements in which there was no trouble coming from Gaza. But essentially, any kind of deal like that would have the effect of entrenching Gaza more, Hamas more deeply in Gaza, extending it a measure of international recognition, which Israel has always been very, very suspicious of. And for that reason, my suspicion is that we will continue to see such press reports, and there will be some continued interest in Gaza from this, and perhaps some flurries of interest in specific security circles in Israel in exploring that kind of arrangement. But I can't see anything viable coming out of this as long as it's done in the context of an international of an international situation in which Hamas is still very much pariah and Israel is anxious not to relax that in any other way. The only other ideas that I've heard explored here in Washington would be a less political set of arrangements in which you would have some relaxation in the siege in Gaza in such a way that it would be kept under perhaps authority of the West Bank Palestinian Authority, or perhaps under some kind of international sponsorship, and essentially a shift in thinking in some parts of the American government that say this is, there's no hope of a political breakthrough anytime soon. There is, however, a very, very pressing humanitarian crisis, and it is in the interests of all to address that humanitarian crisis, even absent any political progress. So I think there's some interest in Washington in that idea. There's some interest in European circles in that idea. But again, I suspect that they will run run aground on the political situation in which any move out of the current impasse will benefit or one party at the expense of another, and there are so many parties that have vetoes that can essentially disrupt any kind of arrangement that I expect this to be much more talk than action. So in a sense, what we're dealing with is a situation that is like it was in 2007, but perhaps a little bit more bleak, I think, for the population in Gaza, and in which most people expect there to be some kind of crisis, perhaps another round of fighting at some point, which will press the issue on the international agenda, but no short-term hope of really breaking what is an arrangement that, as I say, seems to serve nobody's long-term interest, but right now any movement away from would be damaging to the short-term interests of one powerful party or another, whether it's Israel, Hamas, Fatah, and so on. So let me bring my formal remarks to an end, and happy to take the discussion anywhere people would like.
Okay, great. So we'll now have a question and answer period. Again, if you have a question, you will need to press star 6 to unmute your call. But we ask that you re-mute your call as soon as you're done asking your question to eliminate background noise. Also, please refrain from entering into a debate with Nathan or another person or asking follow-up questions. So we will now take a question.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on.
Oh, okay. Hi, I'm Jack Greenblatt. I was wondering, you mentioned a lot of factors, of course, about a very, very complicated, very sad situation. But you didn't mention anything about the role of civilian society. Certainly the people of Gaza have a right to say, well, we don't prefer to have a war which will cause so many thousands dead, will decimate our economy. Don't they have any power to have a say in this whole matter when their very lives are at stake?
That's
my
question. Yeah, okay, it's a fantastic question, and I think the basic answer I would say would be no, and that is a problem. There are no prospects of elections anytime soon. In order to agree to elections, I think you'd have to have some kind of Palestinian reconciliation, and that doesn't seem to be in the cards anytime soon. So there was a vital Palestinian civil society that has grown up, really in some ways back to the British Mandate and probably flourishing a lot during the Oslo years of the 1990s. Since a lot of that came under severe pressure in the Second Intifada, that is after 2000, when those kinds of organizations saw a lot of international assistance dry up. It also has come under pressure since 2007 and the cementing of Hamas rule in Gaza. I've only been in Gaza once since 2007. That was, I guess, 3 years ago. But one of the things that I tried to look for was how it was that independent Palestinian civil society organizations or other opposition political parties were able to organize. And essentially, they were kept under sharp eyes from the Ministry of Interior. The Ministry of Interior was very suspicious of any kind of Palestinian civil society organization that seemed to be aligned with the political opposition, that means, you know, with Fatah or one of the left-wing factions. And so they allowed organizations to continue so long as they didn't pursue any kind of political agenda. And they keep very close watch on Fatah, which would be the biggest potential political challenge, and also to Salafi groups and possible allies of ISIS. And so they keep very, very close grips on the Gaza Strip. My own sense is that political impasse within Palestinian society is, in a sense, part of the problem. You have a Palestinian political leadership right now, not just in Gaza, but also in the West Bank, that feels no pressure from its own population. And that's bad news. So that in the few times that I do make policy recommendations, one of the things that I say is that any move towards Palestinian elections would force this leadership to come back to its population and come up with some kind of viable program other than kind of slogans and resistance and that sort of thing. But I don't see that happening anytime soon.
I'm not sure whether we're asking questions. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, this is Reg Schneiderman. I wanted to ask you, every time a reference is made to the Sharon withdrawal from Gaza, it is always qualified withdrawal as unilateral. I want to have you elaborate a bit on unilateral and what it means. My assumption has always been that unilateral meant that Sharon planned to leave with no consideration given to who would fill the power vacuum. Now, given the trade-off between Fatah and Hamas, one would have imagined that there'd be great advantage in being sure that Fatah and not Hamas filled the vacuum. In fact, Fatah could have gotten some credit for the fact that we were actually evacuating settlements. Instead, he appears to have left the power vacuum ultimately filled by Hamas. Now, what's your understanding of unilateral?
I think my understanding of unilateral will be fairly close to yours. That the Sharon initiative for unilateral withdrawal was predicated not on the existence of the peace process, but on there being no effective peace process. And therefore, the idea that the Palestinian Authority, that Mahmoud Abbas, was a partner and should be regarded as a partner as part of the process was an anathema. Going back a little bit, before the unilateral withdrawal, in the first years of the when Sharon became premier, a lot of his people would talk a little bit more frankly about this, that they regarded the Palestinian Authority as an organization that was not Israel's friend, that was a possible way of protecting or bankrolling organizations that were hostile to Israel, that were engaged in terrorism, and so on. And the alternative would be a collection of sort of local Palestinian leaders in various places who would be essentially local warlords so that Israel could continue basic security control of the West Bank and Gaza by dealing with such figures directly rather than through a single Palestinian national entity and a political authority. I don't know if that's the thinking that went behind the sharply unilateral nature of the Gaza withdrawal, but what I can say is that the attempt to work out a meaningful diplomatic process by which Israel would not simply withdraw, but would hand over areas and assets that are controlled within the Gaza Strip over to the Palestinian Authority, was one that the Palestinian Authority tried to pursue. It was one that American and European diplomacy tried to facilitate, and the Israeli government at the time, for whatever reason, just did not seem interested in that.
In that respect, that seems like a horrible error.
I think it probably was an era. I would say that I wouldn't necessarily draw a direct line from that to the Hamas seizure, because that was in 2005. The elections which Hamas won were not until 2006. So I'm not sure things would have been different without that, but I do think, I would agree essentially that the idea that Israel can deal with the Palestinians not as a national community, but as a potential, as sort of a group of local communities, is one that I think offers no viable long-term solution to an Israeli state that wants to secure existence within the region. What it does is guarantee a continuing festering conflict, which will periodically impose itself in some very nasty ways on Israel.
David Abraham, continuing that last question, could you comment on the extent to which you think current negotiations between Israel and Hamas are a kind of seat-of-the-pants policy on the Israeli side versus the extent to which it's a systematic effort to prevent unification of the Palestinian movements and populations to prevent a...
In terms of what the Israeli strategy is, if there is one, it's difficult to say because, of course, the official Israeli line is there are no direct or indirect contacts like this. What you will hear is speculation, as they say. You'll hear about the reports in the Palestinian press or Arab world press being replicated, and you'll sometimes hear Israeli intellectuals or some public figures talking about this as a possibility. It doesn't seem to me to be married to any kind of long-term strategy. I'm not sure it's so much a Machiavellian attempt to keep the Palestinian population divided. I think that the Israeli leadership still does not see Palestinian unity as a goal and doesn't see the policy that I say dates back at least to the early Sharon years of dealing with the Palestinians not as a single national leadership but as a collection of local communities, I think largely continues, at least at the most senior levels. But I'm not sure that's so much behind as simply an acknowledgement on the part of the part of the Israeli leadership that they have no viable long-term plan for dealing with Gaza, and in the absence of one, a repeat of last summer's war is likely to happen, and that is going to not simply be potentially bloody, it's extremely costly to Israel internationally, diplomatically, so on. And so as a way of preventing that, there's periodic interest in exploring some kind of arrangements. And let me remind people that the war last year ended, in a sense, with an agreement by Israel to negotiate directly, I should say not directly, but indirectly, but very publicly, not simply with Hamas, but with Islamic Jihad. The Egyptians were sponsoring talks in Cairo, which were publicly announced, in which you had representatives of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and Israel both participating. Those negotiations didn't result in any kind of real agreement. But the idea that Israel is not going to negotiate with Hamas was, in a sense, publicly given a real nail in the coffin at the end of last summer, because they were doing so very, very openly.
This is Ralph Seliger. I'd like to ask you a kind of a chicken and egg question. Do you have a sense of the sequence between the blockade of Gaza and violence coming out of by Hamas, mainly rocket attacks? Was the blockade imposed as a result of the rocket attacks, or was it basically imposed as a precaution right after the withdrawal? And could you give us a sense of what the blockade has looked like and what it kind of looks like now? Because I understand there's been some modifications and some easing, and we know the blockade was never a complete blockade, or else there would have been widespread starvation in the Gaza Strip.
Yes, it's a great question, and I don't know how much detail I can give an answer. I mean, I did, as I mentioned, the idea of closing off the Gaza Strip and separating it off economically dates back long before the Second Intifada. It dates back actually even to the eve of the Oslo process. It dates back to the early 90s. And that was not supposed to be a total blockade. It was supposed to be a fence around the Gaza Strip and a way in which Israel could control access both in terms of goods and especially human population, labor and popular movement between Gaza and Israel. The Palestinians accepted that a little bit reluctantly, but the idea that there should be separation between Palestinians and Israel was one that was, in a sense, in accordance with Palestinian national objectives. But they absolutely insisted that the Gaza area be linked with the West Bank, and it was an absolute a condition of the original Oslo Accord that Gaza and the West Bank be linked through a safe passage. That safe passage essentially never really operated. There was a brief period of about 10 months or so before the eruption of the Second Intifada, where a restricted safe passage between Gaza and the West Bank operated. But essentially, if you're talking about the separation, and I'm saying separation, not total blockade, the separation of Gaza and a little bit of its sort of encapsulation economically, it really dates back to the early 1990s. With the eruption of the Second Intifada, a much more severe set of restrictions is placed on Gaza that is both economic and population, but it's built on the infrastructure in terms of fences and crossings and so on that was laid down in the early 1990s. It is expanded, and you have things like the creation of a no man's land along the borders of the Gaza Strip and so on. When Israel withdraws from Gaza unilaterally in 2005 and Hamas seizes control in 2006 and 2007, the closure becomes very, very severe. The way that it is dealt with is, I mean, there is an international agreement on movement and access that the Americans helped negotiate with at the time of the unilateral Israeli withdrawal from Gaza back in 2005.
that involves some Palestinian authority and control over border crossings and European participation and so on. That is never really implemented. And it's completely disrupted when Hamas takes control. So since 2007, the entry in and out of Gaza has been largely through the Egyptian end. Now, the Egyptians have been very suspicious of any Israeli attempt essentially to force Hamas off and Gaza off on them. So they have kept an above ground closure every bit as severe as the Israelis. That was essentially the Gaza population got around that by digging tunnels across the Gaza-Egyptian border. And there was a very flourishing tunnel trade that existed until a couple years ago between Gaza and Egypt. The population on the Egyptian side made great amounts of money. Hamas could tax the tunnels. It was also a way of keeping basic supplies inside Gaza. And as a result, it was in a set of arrangements that was almost absurd, because you had very elaborate tunnel system that everybody knew was existing, operating, but it was one that served the short-term interests of all parties. Israel could avoid having any passage through its territory. Hamas could tax the tunnels. The population of Gaza had access to basic goods, and some of the Egyptian population and even Egyptian officials could make money off of that trade. With the new government in Egypt in the last couple of years, one that identifies Hamas as a little bit of a threat, that tunnel traffic has basically come to a halt, and the movement of goods in and out of Gaza is now very sharply controlled by both the Egyptians and the Israelis. They all have an interest in ensuring that Gaza does not become a place where there's a mass starvation, and that has been, I think, successfully avoided. However, there is a real a humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip that deals not with necessarily starvation, but with lack of access to the basic kinds of materials that are necessary for reconstruction. Exactly what's holding that up is a little bit less clear. And it may be a little bit of everybody. The Israelis are, for instance, very suspicious of getting concrete into Gaza because they claim it can be used to fortify underground installations. The West Bank leadership does not want to take responsibility for Gaza and therefore is not really pushing the issue. Hamas is perhaps not interested in, I mean, they're interested in breaking the blockade, but they're not interested in necessarily negotiating a set of arrangements that completely bypass them. So the population of Gaza over the last year, I think, has been especially hard hit by the blockade, and there is no international domestic political will to find some kind of solution out of it.
Okay, next question.
Hello, this is Ilan Peleg. My question is a larger question, and Nathan, have you seen any ideological development on the part of Hamas in terms of looking at the relationship with Israel beyond the sort of long-term ceasefire or Hudna, and toward the recognition of some kind of partition of the land, two-state solution, or anything along these lines? Or is this completely and totally out of the question?
That's a good question, and I think the answer is it's not out of the question, but it's not. There's no clear sign of Hamas's movement in that direction, and there's a reason for that. Hamas is a movement that basically prides itself on having very fixed principles, and in that sense, it's a very principled movement, but it's not a movement of intellectuals. It's a movement of practical people, and their ideology is, as a result, very vague. What they say is they are committed to a solution in which Hamas would never recognize the state of Israel. There are all kinds of formulas that could build on loopholes in there. For instance, they will say, you know, look, Likud never really recognized these as the Palestinians as a national entity, and yet there's, you know, the Israeli government is still bound by the agreements that were reached by labor. And in the same way, you know, don't ask us to change our platform, but we would participate under a PLO umbrella or under some sort of national unity leadership in agreements. And if they were ratified through some sort of legitimate process, we would disagree with them, but we would accept them as a legitimate decision on the part of the Palestinian population as a whole. There are formulas like that that people will float, both certainly a lot in private and then occasionally in public you'll have hints in that direction. Is Hamas moving in that direction? I mean, I think the answer is parts of it would love to move it in that direction, then parts of it would absolutely resist moving in that direction. And there's nothing like these forces to make that choice.
The military wing and the political people?
It's not quite that simple, I think, between the military and the political. It is, Hamas is a diverse movement, and the military people are kind of all for resistance, but they don't necessarily have a strong long-term political vision. I think the people who would pursue that most strongly would not necessarily be the political wing in Gaza, but the international wing of Hamas, those the people who are more active internationally, who were headquartered in Damascus. Now they're split between Doha and some other places. The Hamas leadership on the West Bank, there are some parts of them who I think would be more interested in exploring that kind of an idea. But Hamas as a movement is never really been pressed with that kind of sharp decision. So until they do so, they can essentially, I think, continue to speak out of all sides of their mouths, to hint at that as a possibility, but not to commit themselves to it. And a movement like Hamas, I think, which is so broad, my guess is you would see a clear ideological statement, not as the first step, but as the last step. In other words, they might agree to a set of practical arrangements which amounted to recognition of Israel, but in the same way as, I mean, the analogy that I would like to use here is the revisionist movement and the Likud and the acceptance of Jordan as a state. If you ask people who are historical revisionists, when did the Likud or revisionist movement come to terms with or abandon both sides of the Jordan, people kind of scratch their heads and they don't think about it anymore, and yet the fact was that this was a reality which that movement accommodated itself with long before it issued any kind of ideological statement accepting the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan as a legitimate political entity. Thank you.
I have a question. Nathan?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did the war on Gaza in 2014 by Israel, with over 550 children killed and close to 2,000 civilians killed, over 1,000 children permanently disabled, and Hamas fighting, being basically the only representatives from Gaza to stand up to Israel in the eyes of their population, did it actually cause Hamas to increase its popularity, because there had been a lot of dissatisfaction with Hamas rule? But does the war on Gaza actually increase Hamas's popularity within the Gazan population?
I think so, yes. I mean, I haven't been there in the last year, so I can't say for sure. So what we're dealing with are public expressions, the Palestinian press and social media and that sort of thing, and we're dealing with public opinion polls. But that seems to be the case, and it sounds a little bit odd at first. I mean, Hamas helped lead the Gazan population into a military conflict which had absolutely disastrous results. So how can it increase their popularity? I think it's perceived by the Palestinians as differently, as what this was an attempt by the Israeli leadership to basically smash any Palestinian resistance, and Hamas was, I mean, exactly as you put it, the one faction that would stand up. And you had, in essence, the West Bank leadership that seemed to be cheering on of any campaign against Hamas, and therefore it was one that may have undermined their legitimacy. My guess is that it probably increased Hamas' popularity in the West Bank even more than it would have in Gaza. In the West Bank, it was what we can see from student association elections and a little bit from, I mean, I was there last in January, and people would talk about pro-Hamas people in the West Bank. There's no overt Hamas organization in the West Bank. It's the press. But people who are known to be pro-Hamas essentially kind of spreading their stuff in public, saying, look what Hamas can do while other Hamas can't do anything. So the West Bank seems to have really seriously had that effect. I suspect in Gaza, and this is a guess on my part, that led to a short-term boost in Hamas's popularity, but long-term, just total despair, that nothing seems to work, and that, Hamas may have kept to its principles and may have, avoided being completely dismantled by the Israelis, and what people will say is, look, Israel did not send its military into populated areas like it did in the previous military campaigns, so in a sense it was, they were able to make Israel pay a much higher price. And so while people may have had that reaction short-term, long-term, the simple fact is that Hamas has no viable program to show the Gazan population. So I suspect over the long-term it will lead simply to further demoralization in Gaza Strip. But again, that is just a guess.
Well, a lot of that has to do with the fact that the world is totally dysfunctional in trying to provide aid to Gaza. And I just read that you had mentioned UNRWA earlier. About a week ago, it came out that UNRWA is facing its worst financial crisis in its history, and they're considering not reopening 700 schools in Gaza, which serve as 500,000 Gazan students. Gaza already, obviously, has the highest unemployment rate in the world. It's not just Hamas. It's an impossible situation. The world seems completely at a loss to try to help the situation. Reconstruction's hardly begun. I mean, it's seemingly hopeless at this point.
This is Andy Winnick in L.A. May I ask a question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there a response to the other thing, Nathan?
Well, not particularly. That. I'd like to ask a question in a slightly broader context. I mean, if I may, the analogy of the Warsaw Ghetto, when you lock people up, they have no food, they have no hope, they have no way out, the leadership seems ineffective. Eventually you reach a point where the only moral position is to fight back and to try to break out. Israel's not stupid. And I think that they, in fact, understand that. I mean, if you put 1.5 million people in the largest outdoor prison in the world, you don't allow it adequate fishing. You don't. With Egypt, you close it off there. I mean, it almost seems to me that Israel is quite content with, in essence, a process of starvation, paying the international price, and as the phrase they use is trimming the grass. You actually, the military uses, it's okay. Every few years, we'll have to go in and fight a war and kill off a bunch of militants and close a few tunnels, but basically let them starve. I don't understand what vision Israel has about a future that seems to project this sort of image.
Yes, I think that's correct. I mean, I think there is a lack of vision. I mean, let me actually tie this together with the previous comment about UNRWA. I mean, here's the odd thing is that I think that there is a recognition on the part of most of the Israeli leadership that the situation in Gaza is not great long term, that there is no, that they have no viable long term option, and therefore they are forced to deal with a series of short term measures. One of those short-term measures is international assistance. The Israelis complain about UNRWA all the time, absolutely, but the fact is they're absolutely dependent at the same time on UNRWA to provide a level of social services. So UNRWA is a good political whipping boy for the government to complain about the use of their schools and this sort of thing. But when push comes to shove, the Israeli government is very supportive of continued funding and continued activities by UNRWA. The same thing referring to the policy of mowing the grass. That is one that is in a sense, the result of an absence of a policy. And it's not an attractive long-term option for the Israelis, because what they saw last summer was that once fighting starts, they don't have an easy way of controlling it. You have had you had a war that went on far longer than I think anybody anticipated last summer. When fighting erupts, and in the Israeli case, you do not have a clear articulation of what exactly the objectives are, but it seems to be simply sort of cutting Hamas down to size. You have no clear way of guiding military operations. And as a result, Israel is essentially dependent on a series of short-term tactics, periodic military conflict, harsh responses to rocket fire, cooperating with international assistance so long as it doesn't seem to go through Hamas and that sort of thing, but no long-term solution whatsoever. It's for that reason that I think that I actually take seriously the reports about some kind of possibility or some kind of interest in some Israeli circles in negotiating some sort of longer-term arrangement with Hamas. I think those reports are serious. I just don't think that they will lead to anything. But right now what you have is an Israeli leadership that has no long-term vision, not simply for Gaza, but for the Palestinian issue generally, and that regards the status quo as not all that great, but no alternative presents itself. So they're content at this point to live with a series of sort of short-term tactical adjustments to this policy, and it's one that, say, serves the Palestinian population horribly in the short term and the long term. And for the Israelis, I think it's livable for the short term, but long term, I think, sort of accentuates doubts in Israeli society about the long-term viability of the Zionist project. And I think actually is ultimately demoralizing for Israel as well, but just demoralizing in a way that doesn't force itself on the political leadership to find a solution for anytime soon.
But if I may, if on the other hand Israel were to lift the blockade, still close off Gaza to Israel, I suppose, but lift the blockade by sea, by air, so that they, you know, and they can impose whatever customs restrictions to make sure there are no weapons coming through and so forth. But basically lifted the blockade, yes, Hamas would probably be strengthened, but Israel would basically no longer be viewed as quite the pariah that it is internationally. It would basically remove a festering sore, and it might remove any motivation on the Palestinians' part to provoke another conflict. I mean, it would seem that there is a positive output for Israel for, you know, biting its tongue on Hamas, which, by the way, has said it is willing to recognize Israel if Israel were willing. That would have to be the outcome of a process, not the beginning of a process. It's not a precondition. It's what comes out of the situation. And they've made it clear that they're not going to forswear violence forever, but they're willing to enter into a 5-10 year a peace treaty or whatever, an armistice, for as long as necessary to carry it out. And they've made it clear that, so, as you mentioned, that so long as there's a referendum and the Palestinian people approve it, they're perfectly willing to go along with Fatah and the PLO negotiating a two-state solution. I mean, it seems to me that the intransigence and the lack of vision, if anything, is primarily on the Israeli side.
I think there's a great competition for the least visionary actor in here, but yes, the current Israeli leadership might be in first place. On the idea of sort of opening up Gaza, that is an idea that is being talked about right now. And it might be something like building an offshore port, which would be under some kind of international oversight, so that there could be some kind of inspection. I think those are the ideas that people take seriously now in a way that they didn't. I'm not optimistic about them coming to an agreement. There are too many, Israel will be very, very suspicious about what's going through that port and might put very, very sharp restrictions, which Palestinians may not agree to. The Palestinian Authority in the West Bank might not want to be part of kind of arrangements that would be, they would be ones that might be, manning the port, and they may not want to get involved. So there's all kinds of practical problems, which I think would be difficult to overcome politically, but it is an idea that is being taken seriously right now.
And it does, a more specific question, you were talking about circles in Israel that may be involved in this kind of negotiation. Could you be a little bit more specific, especially now that it seems to me that anything like that has to go directly from the Prime Minister's office, that nothing will happen unless Bibi Netanyahu is behind it on something as important and as big as that one?
I think you're probably right about who has to approve it, and in answer to your question, can I be more specific? The answer is no, I can't. I mean, I read the same press articles everybody else does. My suspicion is that there are some security circles who are interested in exploring the idea, but until the very top political echelon is on board, this will simply remain idle speculation and talk. On the Palestinian side, there's convictions that that Turkey is negotiating this, and Tony Blair has been involved in these kinds of discussions and so on. And I suspect that's a little bit of wishful thinking on the Palestinian part about how seriously these ideas are being taken. So I suspect that it's one that will continue to excite some Israeli interest, but until there's a really senior political determination that these are ideas that are worth exploring, I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
So I think we have time for one more question, and then we'll have to close out. Is there another question?
Well, I'll throw one out. You had mentioned briefly about the 2006 civil war between the PA and Hamas. Can you go into more detail about the role that the U.S. and Israel played in fomenting it and training the Palestinian Authority and encouraging them to, militarily confront Hamas?
Yes, I mean, some of this has now become a matter of public record. When Hamas won the Palestinian Legislative Council elections in January 2006, there was a clear international effort led by the Bush administration to make it impossible for them to govern, and that was done primarily through fiscal pressure. The PA is dependent on getting revenue transfers from Israel. Israel collects the VAT and then hands it on to the Palestinian Authority. So those revenue transfers were halted. There was a halt of international assistance, and that sort of thing. When after a couple of months Hamas still formed the cabinet, that policy carried over, and the United States very reluctantly agreed to a mechanism by which the Europeans would pay the salaries of certain, or parts of the salaries of a certain PA employees. But essentially, what the result was a very strong message to Palestinians that said, as long as you are being ruled partly by Hamas, you're going to be scrambled. And there was real economic hardship placed as a result. In addition to that, there was international assistance given to Palestinian security forces that were under presidential control rather than under, which was still Abu Mazen, Fatah, rather than under cabinet control of the Ministry of Interior, which was controlled by Hamas. It seems to me that that training, some of which was done by the Egyptians, some of which was done by the Jordanians, was actually disastrous because it was not done in such an extensive manner that you had any viable alternative force, but it telegraphed to Hamas that a coup is being planned against you. And as a result, it essentially led to a military confrontation between Fatah and Hamas, which these newly trained security forces simply couldn't win. And that's what essentially happened in the summer, in June of 2007 in Gaza, when new security forces under command of Mohamed Dahlan and Fatah and under presidential control were being there was an attempt to put them on the streets of Gaza, but without giving them anywhere near the kind of support that they would need in order to face down the Hamas security forces. So this was a conflict that really only took a matter of a couple of days before Hamas was able to assert full control of the Gaza Strip.
So you're not, you mentioned Jordanian and Egyptian training. but not CIA and not Mossad or Israeli.
It's hard to know exactly what went on. I mean, there were American legal restrictions on what kind of assistance could be given. So it could be non-lethal, which means that they could give them uniforms but not weapons, but the Jordanians could give them weapons and so on. So there's clearly a lot going on. Exactly what, and there's clearly some training going on in Jordan, but exactly who was responsible for what and how extensive it was is difficult for me to say.
Okay, thank you. Ethan, thank you so much. You really contributed to a greater understanding of what's going on in Gaza right now. We'll be actually continuing this conversation next week on Wednesday at noon. You can register online, progressiveisrael.org, and we'll be continuing the conversation on Gaza with Gershon Baskin. So thank you again for joining us, and thank you again, Nathan.
Thanks for having me.